Wisconsin Consumer Protection will come to order for Thursday, April 2nd. We have a quite a long agenda, but we're getting kind of a late start due to the session overrun. So we're going to be dealing with Senator Pappas's bill, Senator Scheid's bill, Senate File 312, Senate Scheid's bill, Senate File 1743, and if time permits, Senate File 1905 for members of the audience. But with that, Senator Pappas, welcome back to the Commerce Committee with Senate File 518.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been some further discussions, and I understand that Senator Scheid has an amendment to offer relative to the fee schedule.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I do. It's the A5 amendment. I think members have it on top of their folders. We handed it out just a bit ago, and I want to make sure that Senator Pappas has
yeah, maybe
a copy
somebody
of it.
Could
I think
give me the A5.
I think B is bringing you one. Is that where they are? They in the there we go. Okay. And
Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it struck me the other day, I guess it was Tuesday, that there was the largest stumbling block had to do with the fees, and that the committee was concerned about not wanting to put people out of business. On the other hand, not wanting to do harm to consumers. And I strongly support what Senator Pappas is doing with this bill. I have had some concerns about the fee structure. And actually, I think my amendment offers a structure that I think is needed. One of the concerns that Senator Pappas and others raised was the idea of front-loading all the fees and then maybe not getting all the work done, not getting people's debt reduced very quickly and or because money was coming out every month. And this sets in place a structure. I want to say this. These numbers are not etched in stone, but the structure, I think, is pretty solid. It may need a little tinkering, but I think there will still be conversations about the amounts. So what I want is that up front, and I've got in here a non-refundable origination fee of not more than $500, then starting in the fourth month, a monthly fee of up to $50. And if the debt is $20,000 or less, you have 2 years to get it done. If it's more than $20,000, you have 3 years. And at the end, the debt settlement services provider could charge it a settlement fee equal to 10% of the savings. I like linking this to the savings because I think it makes the provider of this service work harder to achieve that savings for people. But as I said, I've been told that this still would put some people out of business because of these numbers. I don't think it's the structure that would. And that's a consideration. I mean, it may be that some people think that that is a business we should not, you know, have doing business in Minnesota, but I think there's still room to work so that this can work for these companies, but certainly work. We need the regulation. It's not regulated in Minnesota right now. We need to do it, and so it is in that spirit that I'm offering the A5 amendment. Mr. Chairman, I'd move that.
Thank you. Let the record state that a quorum is present. Senator Pappas, would you like to comment on the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Scheid. I do support the amendment. I think that we don't want to kill the good in search of the perfect, and we'll continue to have a dialogue here as we move to the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, does the $500, is that included in the 10% cap? The origination fee?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think so.
Okay, thank
no,
you.
It's not intended to.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I was having kind of the same question or concern, and the way I was reading this, and certainly it's your amendment, so it should reflect your intent, but I liked the fact that I thought it did include it because I was looking at line 1.23, where it says the savings shall be calculated as it has to be 10% of the savings, and then it says the savings shall be calculated as the difference between the aggregate debt that is stated in the debt settlement service agreement and the total amount the debtor actually pays to settle all the debt stated in the debt services agreement. So I guess I was thinking that these other fees would be part of that total amount the debtor was paying.
Certainly the monthly fees.
I'm not sure if that was your intent.
Senator Scheid.
I just need to read those lines. I'm sorry. Stated. Okay, we know what the aggregate debt, let's say it's $20,000. That's stated in the agreement. The total amount the debtor actually pays to settle all the debts. To me, that means the amount going against the debt. That would mean if they paid off $10,000 worth of debt, you don't count the fees. That's a cost, I understand, that's being borne, or a fee that's being borne by the debtor. But I'd encourage members to not nitpick too much about these numbers. I think they're still, you know, they are still a work in progress. But what I consider important is that the structure is in here so that we don't have people front-loading big fees and then not getting the work done, not having to worry about getting their fee at the end if they don't maximize the savings that would be available to a client, perhaps. So, Senator Olson, the intent is that that doesn't go into the fee that may be charged. I mean, at the end, it would be 10% of the actual savings. So, if they settled $10,000, the fee would be 10% of that $10,000 that's remaining. That's been resolved.
Senator Vanderbilt.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I don't have a problem with that. I was just trying to clarify it. So I think it makes sense the way it is.
Okay, Senator Scheid renews her motion that the A5 amendment be adopted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, then
Senator
Mr. Chairman, then I move that Senate File 518 as amended be recommended to pass and we referred to judiciary.
Judiciary. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much,
thank
Senator
you very
Pappas.
Much.
Senator Pappas, thank you.
Senator Scheid, Senate File 312. And we know this is a very important bill, but what we'd like to do is take 20 minutes of testimony for the proponents, 15 minutes for those that are opposed to the bill, and then we'll leave 15 minutes for committee discussion. We'll try to stick to that if possible.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Chairman, to all the children and the parents here, the end is in sight in terms of you're having to sit here. Everybody's doing so well, and I'm just really impressed. And I'm pretty excited to bring this legislation before you. And Ms. Dawson came to me to ask me if I would consider carrying this bill. I shared with her, and I've shared with pretty much everybody, that I'm no expert on autism, no expert at all.
I'll scratch on that.
I know that it covers a spectrum of disorders. There are different levels or layers, and I know that it's a serious issue for families, for children, and their parents, for schools, and we really ought to be having the conversation and talking about it. And so this bill, I probably should put that language right in front of myself, talks about health plans providing, it describes medically necessary care that we want health plans to, and people are talking about this as a new mandate, and I'd argue that I don't think, I'm not looking at it that way. I think that we're talking about medically necessary care that's determined by a doctor, by a family doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist, physicians and licensed psychologists, and that there are already plans that cover the services that we're going to describe here for you, and that you're going to learn something, I hope, about intensive early intervention behavior services. Did I get it right?
Yes, sir.
And I know that everybody on this committee knows that the earlier you're able to deal with any issue, and for those of us on the education committee, I know, you know, day in and day out, we know what the costs are when we don't have kids ready for school. We know what the costs are when kids' hearing impairments perhaps are not identified till too late or not too late, but later than they could have been. And the work that we can do with children very early is that's the smartest money we spend. And I'm suggesting that even though you're going to hear that this is very expensive, I'd submit that it's much more expensive at the end of the day for us not to get coverage for some of people. Many people have coverage in Minnesota. I guess our CGIP plan and medical assistance cover this therapy, and Ms. Dawson is going to tell you, give you the kind of information you're really going to need to make it, you know, an intelligent decision about this bill. But I just wanted to lay out what I'm looking for.
Ms. Dawson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm an estate planning attorney, an autism lobbyist. I have two clients, so I'm sort of a part-time lobbyist. One of my clients is the Lovaas Institute, and they provide therapy to my son who has autism. My other client is Partners in Excellence. They both provide therapy to kids who have autism. And I only mention that in the interest of full disclosure. These are my twins, Malcolm and Eleanor. I hope you can see that picture I lugged in here. And my name is Amy Dawson. Our twins were born prematurely, and our son, Malcolm, had a lot of special health care needs. Malcolm required supplemental oxygen for 18 months, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, countless procedures, tests, and surgery. Malcolm racked up close to $2 million in private insurance claims by the time he was 2 years old, and private insurance coverage was never a problem, not until he was diagnosed with autism. Standards for health insurance coverage should not be based on the diagnosis an individual receives, but upon medical necessity, and that's why we're here today. We're not here to ask for a new insurance mandate. We're here to ask for your help because some state-regulated insurance companies are not following existing state law. Minnesota has mental health parity and even a definition of medical necessity in the context of mental health. Yet some state-regulated health insurance companies are not following these laws. This legislation ends the discrimination by insurance plans against autism by clearly and unequivocally requiring them to cover medically necessary care. Individuals who have autism are all different, and they need different options for treatment and therapy. This legislation expands those options by requiring private insurance coverage for all medically necessary care and treatment. It concerns more than just one type of therapy, but one specific type of therapy has been the focus of the debate, intensive behavior therapy, which has many names. It's also called intensive early intervention behavior therapy, EIIBT, applied behavior analysis, or ABA, and early intensive behavior intervention, or EIBI, just to name a couple. It is the model of intensive behavior therapy that has been the subject of more than 1,000 studies, and it is accepted as evidence-based medicine by the U.S. Surgeon General, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Institute of Mental Health, the U.S. Bureau of Maternal and Child Health Care, the University of Minnesota's Autism Spectrum Disorders Clinic, and the Mayo Clinic. I've provided the committee with a couple of articles, one from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which found that this is evidence-based therapy, and another from some specialists at the Mayo Clinic. The chief author is Barbara Reese. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, which has about 36% of the state-regulated market, covers IEIBT. They have covered it ever since the state's attorney general sued them over mental health parity. The other major providers of state-regulated health insurance specifically exclude intensive early intervention behavior therapy. In fact, the language that was added to this bill by the amendment adopted in the House, and that I think it is before you today,
I'm going to offer that,
is based on the language found in typical medical and health partners' policies. Because intensive early intervention behavior therapy is evidence-based and clinically effective, families who can afford expensive lawyers are routinely able to advocate and win coverage for this type of therapy. Most families, however, simply turn to MA through TEFRA or MCHA, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Right. Their plans cover it too. When private insurance abdicates its responsibility to pay for medically necessary care, we all pay the price because the financial burden is shifted to the state. families have to pay their private insurance premium and either a premium for MCHA or the parental fees for MA-TEFRA. As a result, the state pays for the coverage that some of the state-regulated insurance companies are avoiding. And ultimately, all taxpayers and businesses pay not only direct costs, but also indirect costs. And the indirect costs arise when kids who have autism do not have effective early behavior intervention and affordable access to it. The incremental societal cost is enormous, $3.2 million per individual. When kids do have access to intensive early behavior therapy, that cost is dramatically reduced. I've given you a copy of the Chasson study, which shows that in the state of Texas, the individual per pupil cost savings from access to IEIBT is $208,000 per individual across 18 years of public education, for a total savings of $2.09 billion. When our son Malcolm was first diagnosed with autism, we were told he would have a lifetime of high-level needs and would likely never talk. Before he started IEIBT therapy, he spent most of his time disconnected from our family, often sitting in the corner wiggling his fingers in front of his eyes. Now he's on track for best outcomes, which means that he's expected to attain a typical IQ, not need any supports or services in regular mainstream education, and no longer fit the diagnostic criteria for autism. The savings, if he reaches that outcome, is over $3 million to the state. Since this bill started its journey, we've heard a variety of arguments from the opposition. One argument is that this therapy is expensive and it will cause premiums to increase. Well, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota has been covering this therapy for years. And if it were true that covering this therapy would cause premiums to go up, I think they'd show you their data that would help prove their point. The fact is that Blue Cross Blue Shield, if they can cover this therapy for kids who have autism and still have the biggest share of the state-regulated market, then the other plans ought to be able to cover it also without raising premiums. Another argument that we've heard mostly in corridors is an amorphous concern about provider qualifications. But insurance companies can and do address such concerns in provider agreements all of the time. In fact, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota has its provider qualifications and program criteria specifically for this therapy available on the Internet. We've also heard that it will increase costs to the state because SEGIP doesn't cover it. But SEGIP does cover it. And I brought a huge litigation case because in there is a SEGIP benefit set, if anybody would like to see it. A fourth argument that we've heard is that only a small segment of the market will be affected by this bill, about 27.8%. Well, let's put that in perspective. That's $5.6 billion in premiums. I'm not sure how many families that is, but $5.6 billion sounds like a lot. Also, studies show that self-insured plans often adopt state law requirements, so this will help blaze the path. And to top it off, the new Obama administration is also working on the rest of the market. The Autism Treatment Acceleration Act would address this concern, among other issues, at the federal level. I also want you to know this bill is endorsed by both Autism Speaks and the Autism Society of America, because standards for health insurance coverage should be based on medical necessity. I implore you to end the disparity that currently exists, end the discrimination against the diagnosis of autism, shift the financial burden off families and off the state and back where it belongs, onto the private insurance plans for which we pay our premiums. When private insurance fulfills its obligation to cover medically necessary care, it saves families and the state money. Thank you, and I hope you'll support the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Dawson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I should offer the amendment because that does enumerate these different therapies that I think are not enumerated in the original bill. It's the A1. Mr. Stang, it's the A1 amendment. And I'd like to move that to just put it in the order that we should.
Senator Scheid, then this would just match the House language, is that correct?
It does, yes.
Senator Scheid moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
Thank you.
The amendment is adopted.
Sorry, I forgot.
Thank you.
So we have other
an author's amendment?
Dr. Rumsey.
Yeah.
See how long.
That's just about the house, I guess. She wants it that way.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Robin Rumsey. I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist in the Autism Spectrum Disorders Program at the University of Minnesota, and I'm a member of an interdisciplinary team that conducts comprehensive evaluations for possible autism spectrum disorder. I also follow many of the children we have diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders over time in order to monitor their developmental progress and response to intervention. So I'm going to give a quick Autism 101 in about 1 minute, and then I'll get on to the rest of the stuff. So autism spectrum disorders are characterized by difficulties in three areas: social interaction, communication, and restricted interests and repetitive behaviors. There's a wide range of behaviors that can be seen in individuals with autism spectrum disorders. So some individuals with autism spectrum disorder have no language, while others speak fluently but choose to quote from movies or television shows. Some children flap their hands or rock repetitively, while others may have areas of interest that they want to talk all about or learn all about at the exclusion of more typical and age-appropriate activities. For all individuals with autism spectrum disorders, the core area of difficulty is with social interaction. So children who have an autism spectrum disorder may have difficulties using nonverbal behaviors like eye contact, facial expressions, gestures to socially interact or to communicate. They often struggle to make friends or show little or no interest in their peers. They may prefer to be alone rather than around others. They may not be motivated to please others or may not notice when someone is sad or happy or scared. And children with severe autism spectrum disorder may self-isolate to the point that they're not tuned into their environment enough to learn from it, which then significantly impacts future development. So there are five diagnoses on the autism spectrum, and the three most common are autism, Asperger's disorder, and pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. And the other two are Rett's disorder and childhood disintegrative disorder. So individuals who have autism have significant difficulties in all three areas: social interaction, communication, and restricted interests and repetitive behaviors. Individuals who have good language skills but difficulties with social interaction and restricted interest might be diagnosed with Asperger's disorder. And if a child doesn't quite meet the criteria for either autism or Asperger's, but are clearly on the autism spectrum, then they're often given a diagnosis of pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, or PDD-NOS. The diagnosis is best made based on direct observation and parent descriptions of development and behavior by a clinician, or better yet, a team of clinicians experienced in working with individuals on the autism spectrum. So as part of our multidisciplinary team evaluation at the University of Minnesota, we make every effort to connect children we diagnose and their families to appropriate and evidence-based intervention services. We tailor our recommendations to the needs of both the individual child and his or her family, and we often recommend a combination of approaches, including speech-language services, occupational therapy, and special education services. Today, I've been asked to testify specifically in support of early intensive behavioral intervention, or ABA therapy, applied behavior analysis, all those other terms that you've heard, as this is the specific aspect of the proposed bill that insurance companies are fighting and the service that many insurance companies deny. We very regularly recommend ABA therapy for the children we diagnose with an autism spectrum disorder. We know it to be an evidence-based intervention based both on the literature and based firsthand on the tremendous progress that a number of our children have made. ABA therapy helps young children become more tuned into their environment, learn to communicate, and learn to interact more appropriately socially. Children form neural connections in their brains that would not otherwise be formed because of self-imposed social isolation. ABA therapy is tailored to the individual needs of each specific child. While we do not recommend ABA therapy for every child who comes through our clinic, we often make this recommendation for young children with autism spectrum disorder, usually under age 5, who have significant socialization and communication challenges, who cannot learn in a regular preschool setting. The ultimate goal of ABA is to integrate children with autism with typical peers in typical settings. This means they will have an average or higher IQ and be successful in a typical setting with minimal or no additional support. Research has shown that one-third to one-half of children who receive early intensive behavioral intervention achieve this best outcome. Those children who do not make enough gains to be mainstreamed in a typical classroom still can receive significant benefits that greatly improve their quality of life. 30 to 40 hours of one-to-one intervention for at least 2 years may be required to produce a maximum effect. Parent involvement is also necessary for maximum effect. At the U of M, we try to connect children and families with established evidence-based interventions. ABA therapy is one of the therapies for children with autism spectrums that has the most evidence base. What is so frustrating for us is that families receive what is basically a devastating diagnosis. There's a therapy out there that has been shown to be effective. We recommend the therapy, and then parents can't access it. We have parents who cannot afford the monthly payments for TEFRA or EMCHA, or who are so overwhelmed by the application process for funding that they don't follow through. The application process itself has been known to take several months, and that's a loss of several months of therapy. We also have parents who put second and third mortgages on their home to pay for the therapy services out of their pocket. So last year, we recommended ABA therapy to two very savvy families who are employed at the U of M. Their private U of M insurance would not cover the services, and they appealed. We supported these families in the appeals process, met with employee benefits, and provided evidence for the therapy and ideas for monitoring the children's response to the intervention. They ultimately made the decision to cover the therapy. We're very proud of this accomplishment, as it has opened the door for a few more families to receive the benefits of ABA therapy without a fight. Children and families deserve choices, and to eliminate the choice of the most well-studied and effective treatment for autism spectrum disorders known to date just does not make sense. Should private insurances be required to cover ABA therapy, many more children would be served. They would be served at younger ages, leading to even better outcomes. Families would be less stressed, and ultimately there would be a decrease in cost for care over the child's lifetime. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Rumsey. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, when I heard the up to 50% of the children benefit from this, I couldn't help but think of my own treatment for ovarian cancer. There were no questions asked. My insurance plan covered thousands and thousands of dollars when the statistics showed at the time that only 20% of the people with my cancer would survive 5 years. Now, that number has gone up closer to 40%, but it's still not half. And I just want, I couldn't get that out of my head. And I thought there were no questions asked about what my health needs were. And I was 62 or 63 or something when that happened. And these are, Senator Metzen's is smiling at that. He's a year behind me.
Yeah.
So when I weigh those two factors, it was just a no-brainer for me to come down on the side of saying this is smart money. And I know it's expensive, but it will pay off to society at the end of the day. So,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Scheid, for carrying this bill. And I'm just I'm not an expert in this area too either, but I have read a little bit about it. I have a cousin with autism. My understanding is there's a window of opportunity at a young age. I think your witness alluded to that. And if that window of opportunity is lost, it's not likely as likely to be effective in the future.
I think that's true.
Ms. Dawson.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. There are studies that show ABA therapy can be effective across a lifetime, but this model that we're talking about, the intensive early intervention, is designed to be an intensive and time-limited therapy, and it often lasts, well, the earlier you start, the less time it takes. It might only take 2.2 years for a two-year-old. One of my client's partners in excellence has excellent outcome data that we could share with the committee if you'd like. that two-year-olds who start there, the average length of therapy is 2.2 years, and 89% of those kids graduate into mainstream regular education with either zero or very little support. And the time period goes up. My son started at age 4. We think he'll be finished after about 4 years. But after that, but when kids are older, you're not doing the intensive therapy.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. One of them in your amendments, Senator Scheid, on line 1.7. Should applied behavioral analysis be capitalized, applied behavioral analysis, as well as intensive early intervention behavior?
Senator Scheid, Dr. Rumsey?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Rumsey.
Dr. Rumsey.
It's an acronym, so yeah.
Yes, Senator but it is a specific therapy. It is not a conglomeration of behavioral therapies. It is an applied behavioral analysis, right? That has a particular framework and modality. And
ABA therapy is. Oh, I'm sorry. ABA therapy is a broader term, and so there are more specific behavioral approaches that are under the umbrella of ABA therapy. So ABA therapy is an umbrella term.
So,
Senator Prettner-Solin,
Mr. Chair, it is not just it does not denote a complete treatment protocol. It is just a type of protocol, or it is just a type of service that multiple services that could be delivered under applied behavioral analysis, and the same for intensive early intervention behavior. It's not a treatment protocol.
It's not a treatment protocol, and it's tailored to each individual child as to the specific behavioral approaches that would both best fit with the child's strengths and weaknesses. So, for instance, one child may need an approach called discrete trial training, where they're sitting at a table and they're not tuned in to other people, so you prompt for them to reply, and it helps them be more aware of their environment and learn from other people and imitate. Other kids have imitation, so you're going to want to very quickly move to incidental teaching, which is more of a behavioral approach that's used in everyday interactions where you're pressing for an appropriate response and you're getting that response back.
But
Mr. Chair, thank you. However, it would be not unlike rational behavior therapy, which would be capitalized RBT, or Gestalt therapy, which would be capitalized.
Right. I'm not 100% sure, but I always capitalize it.
So. Okay. I think what I'm getting at is I know that Senator Scheid said this was not a mandate, but when you do require specific therapies, then that becomes a mandate, rather than just saying, in her initial bill, she does state, you know, that autism spectrum disorder should not be discriminated against, that it should be treated along with other mental health and behavioral therapies also. But what this is saying is that there are four types of therapies that should be provided, is what it looks like to me.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, but you notice we talk about this would be as determined by physicians as Dr. Rumsey is, and or licensed psychologists who do manage patients' care in this area of mental health, if you will. So this isn't something that somebody just goes out to a company they've read about and signs up for a program. I mean, it would have to have negotiated with plans and be accepted as a provider, just like any other.
Yeah.
Any other?
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I agree. However, I've also been around long enough to know that they used to do bone marrow transplants for breast cancer. Very, very expensive. Believed that it did a good job. Found out that it really had no effect in prolonging the life of somebody with breast cancer. And I think that what happens in clinics is they tend to gravitate toward a particular type of treatment or therapy and to use that exclusively in their clinic. And I just get concerned when we dictate what kind of treatment should be provided rather than leaving it up to what is the best research and the best recommendation of a physician. And I think if you go to a clinic for a type of assessment, they're likely to absorb you into that clinic for that type of treatment.
We don't provide ABA therapy as part of our services at the University of Minnesota. We connect people with those services in the community that we feel are appropriate for the individual child.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rumsey, we need to keep moving along, and I think I understand through some of Mrs. Dawson's testimony, too, that if we catch it earlier, we can do it. But do you have any idea to kind of help the committee understand what kind of costs are involved? I mean, I know we have some parents coming up, and each case is probably a little bit different, but what kind of dollar amounts are we talking about? And again, probably knowing that each case is a little bit different.
Right. I mean, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, well, first of all, you have to keep in mind that not every kid is going to choose this option. Not every family is going to choose this option for their kid. And the providers that I've talked to estimate that less than 20% of families choose this particular therapy. The average really ranges. It could probably range between $30,000 a year and over $100,000. So we're looking at, you know, what could be two, three, four, even more, $100,000 for the intensive period of treatment. For to balance that against a lifetime savings of potentially more than $3 million, an average savings of $1 million, because not, you know, 48% of kids, research shows, achieve best outcomes. According to the U.S. Surgeon General, most kids benefit some from this type of therapy, but they don't all reach that best outcomes. So the average savings is $1 million.
Thank you very much. We need to keep moving. Senator
Shah, I think that we can ask for people who are opposed to speak. I think we've had good explanation of what's involved here. Senator Pretner-Solon, if I may ask her a question, Mr. Chairman, is your committee meeting at 3?
No.
So we have a little extra time, although Senator Olson and I have to get ourselves down to room 15 at some point. But, and I know other members may have other committees. I don't mean, but I know that Senator Pretner-Solon would have to go if she were chairing.
Okay.
So I think we can move to the people who are opposed.
Okay.
And I think the committee can make a fair decision here. I don't want to not let somebody speak who feels they have to, but I think the committee understands.
It's fine, Madam Chair.
So.
Ms. Kimmett, would you like to come forward? Ms. Smith, I have on the list, and maybe Mr. Griffin.
Yes. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I've seen the lady in the paper, right?
Yes.
But I haven't met her before, so she would like to.
Idil Abdul? Yes.
And she would like to speak as a parent.
Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Idil Abdul. I am from Somali American Autism Foundation. I'm a Somali parent that has a child that was born here in Minnesota that is diagnosed with autism. And as Somalis, this is very personal to us for a number of reasons. Number one, Minnesota Health Department found out that Somali children are being diagnosed with autism 7 times more likely than the rest of the population. Now, having said that, a lot of people are talking about the cost and the benefit. I want to leave all of that out. I want to see if I can just get to your heart for a second. And if you can look at some Somali children's pictures, these are our next Obamas. These are children that were born here. We came to this country for a better America, for a better future. And so if you think about it, if you have a child that is diagnosed with any condition, and you take it to a doctor, and the doctor says, here's a therapy that I think could help your kid as it has helped my son, just even to learn imitation and have the ability to sit down for 5 minutes without having a meltdown. Imagine if you are told, no, you cannot go to this, even though medically it's prescribed medicine. I would like you just to think about that. If you have children, if you have a loved child, God forbid any condition or they get a medical condition, when you're making this decision, I understand in today's economy it's very difficult. You want to be cost-effective. But as Amy and the rest of the people have said so eloquently, it outweighs. The benefits outweigh today's cost. I guarantee you that. Because what this therapy does, it makes the children need less and less and less aid. So would you rather have a child get an early intervention therapy right now, or would you rather support them lifetime? Not to mention we will lose better and productive members of our society. Thank you so much. We appreciate your support.
Thanks for your testimony, Ms. Abdul.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
Mr. Barsh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm not Ms. Committer, Mr. Griffin. We're consolidating in the essence of time, so I'll be speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I work for Health Partners, but again, today I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And we do want to share our concerns with the legislation before you. First and foremost, we do think this is a mandate. When you look at the legislation, it's doing a couple things. First, it is requiring coverage for medically necessary care, and then it is defining what is medically necessary in statute. And to our knowledge, that's the first time that statute is used to define medical necessity. It is defined in rule in a couple instances, but not in statute. And to Senator Prettner-Solon's comments earlier, it is specifying what specific treatments are medically necessary in statute, and we think that's a bad precedent moving forward. I do want to talk about the reasons that Health Partners and some of the other health plans currently do not cover IEIBT, which is the same as some of the other acronyms. The reason for our decision not to cover it is we disagree with the proponents in terms of the evidence behind this treatment. They've commented that they do believe it's effective. Our concern is that we don't believe it to be more effective than other forms of treating autism. I handed out some information in a packet for all of you, and the top copy is an article from the Journal of Pediatric. The conclusion of that is circled on the second page, which basically says there's inadequate evidence to support that ABI is more effective than other terms of or than other treatments for autism. And that becomes really important when you're talking about mandating coverage. We do live in a world where health insurance and the cost of health insurance are rapidly outpacing the ability of everyone to afford it. And so we need to be very cautious when we're talking about requiring coverage for a treatment to make sure that if it's a treatment that is as expensive as this treatment is, that it certainly has an impact and is proven effective much beyond what's the current standard. To talk about the cost, some of the other information in the packet is information that this committee already heard this year from the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. If you look, according to MCHA's data, the clinic with the second highest total claims paid in 2007 was Partners in Excellence. This is the Center to Treat Autistic Children. And according to the data we have from MCHA, that's for 50 kids at a total cost of $4.3 million. This is very, very expensive. As you heard the proponents testify, anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000 per year per treatment. Again, that's an enormous expense for one treatment. And when we talk about this in terms of total impact, that's one thing, but think about the small employer who all of a sudden will be saddled with a $100,000 claim to their experience. Their insurance rate in the next year are going to go through the roof. We've heard examples from small employers talking about having a heart attack and that causing their claims to go through the roof. This is $100,000 a year potentially for 3 years in a row. That's going to have a very dramatic impact on small employers and their ability to offer coverage in the marketplace. And I think we need to be very cognizant of it when we're making these decisions. The other information that's included in the packet I sent to you is just some information from the Department of Human Services. There was a little bit of confusion, I think, when this bill was moving forward in the House about whether or not the department covers this for children under MA. They do cover it, not as an MA benefit, but under services for CTSS. The information is in there for you, and you'll just notice on the bottom graph the difference between some of the providers and the costs associated with them with some of the others. And again, when we're talking about the language that's in the bill, medically necessary is defined as what's prescribed by the physician. So that 40 hours of intensive service would be covered regardless of whether or not we as a health plan believe that's appropriate in that situation. That's where the great expense comes from in covering this. And finally, as we flip through the packet, the last thing I included there was a pie chart that we've shared with this committee a number of times, just showing who this language would apply to and who it wouldn't apply to. Specifically, it wouldn't cover the self-insured employers in this state While it's true that often self-insured employers piggyback on what's covered in the fully insured marketplace, when there are instances of coverage that are expensive as this, they do make exceptions to it, and I believe this is one where they clearly would make an exception in terms of whether or not to include it. Last thing I'd want to talk about, I mentioned cost, but one of the testifiers talked about the ability to control which providers you contract with through networks. The federal mental health parity law, which passed in the last year, and we were supportive of, states that you have to have the same mental health benefits as you do for medical benefits. Well, currently, all of our contracts for medical benefits have an out-of-network benefit, meaning you can see a provider who's out of our network and will reimburse a percentage of those charges, usually about 80%. That same requirement would apply to mental health services such as this. So while we may try to limit the network of providers that we have contract with, our members would be able to choose a provider outside of that network, and we'd still be covering a significant portion of that expense. I'll conclude my comments just by saying, again, this is a very emotional issue, and the parents who are here on behalf of their kids are doing a great job, but we also have to consider the impact this has on the people who aren't in the room, those who are trying to pay premiums and trying to provide insurance to their employers. And for those reasons, we oppose the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Scheid, then Senator Pretnisol.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask Mr. Stang to read from 62Q. It's a mental health chapter or section. And I don't know if it's point 53. Anyway, there's language in there, I think, that we mirror pretty closely the language about medically necessary. Here. So it's something we do already. Statute. Mr. Stang, if you could.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, 62Q.53 is the mental health coverage mandate, and that statute is defined in terms of a definition provided in statute for medically necessary care, which I could read if.
That's fine, but I think that we mirror that in the bill. I think it's pretty close. I just wanted to say that we do discuss it in terms of mental health in statute. And I also wanted to just note that just recently, I think maybe in the past week, I've seen an article that individual plans are rising in terms of the plan's ability or people's ability to get insurance coverage. And obviously, people are losing jobs, losing employer-provided health care, et cetera, and the plans are having a very large increase in people who are purchasing in the individual market. So that figure probably is going up from 27% is what we've been thinking about the fully insured market. I think that's on its way up. And it's a small point, but the truth is they are selling more of these individual plans.
Senator Pretnisol.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barch. Barch.
Mr. Anything's fine.
Just vote the right way, though.
Do your plans, though not mandated or required to provide coverage if people are referred to these services, will there be times when you do, or are there times that you currently do? I think the treatment might be appropriate for some people, but not for some people. I'm afraid that as written, it will become something that everybody feels they're entitled to who has a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Do you understand my question?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pretnisol, all the health plans cover autism services. It's really what does their definition of coverage mean? I'll speak for Health Partners example. We do cover speech pathology and a number of the other services that are listed in the requirement here. And in instances, we will contract with providers who do limited ABA therapy. What we don't cover and actually what we exclude in our contract is IEIBT. So we do exclude coverage for that service in our contract.
Mr. Barch, why do you exclude it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pretnisol, again, based on the research that our medical directors have done and looking at the national research databases, we don't believe that IEIBT is a service that has been proven to be more effective than other treatments for autism.
And Mr. Bartsch, how often do you have to turn down a request for services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prentice-Solon, I don't know that off the top of my head. I do know it has happened. I also know of instances where we have covered it accidentally because it was billed or coded under a different situation, and we've had to go back and say, you know, that's our fault. Moving forward, we're not going to cover it. So it does happen from time to time. We do get appeals by family members to cover it, both internally, and then everyone who has that coverage denied has the ability to go to an external appeals process to take their case to someone outside of the health plan.
Senator Olson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just along the lines of a little bit of what Senator Prentice-Solon was saying, and looking at this language, I just thought, and I'm very much in favor of what you're doing, so I hate to open a can of worms, but I was just wondering if there shouldn't be something tying the determination by the physician to the requirement that this be covered, because it does potentially or could be read as saying, and maybe this isn't a problem because it does say that the physician has to determine it, but I think the problem has been all along is that the doctors are saying this is medically necessary treatment, and the there are a lot of reputable associations that support that finding, and yet the insurance policy says they cover medically necessary treatment, and yet they're not paying for this treatment. So you want to make sure that this is within, is not going to be excluded. But I think you certainly also want to make sure that it isn't just an automatic coverage if it isn't recommended by the doctor, or, you know, 20 years from now if there's a better way of treating or something like that. So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
I guess I'm not really recommending an amendment at this time, but if there's any confusion over that, I would be happy to, if anyone thinks there's any confusion over that, I'd be happy to talk about the language.
I think, too, and Senator Scheid, should this committee act favorably, the bill does need to go to Health, Housing,
yes,
and Family Services, so we will have some time to work on it, and that... I mean, it's important. I think we're having a good discussion, but
Mr. Chairman, and I think we may be able to work with that language about the physician's role here. That's fine.
Senator Prentice-Solon.
Mr. Chair, it's appropriate to have a discussion about the policy at Health, Housing, and Family Security, but I'm more concerned about the fact that we're not requiring our public programs to provide this, and so what happens is that the responsibility for covering it falls on a very small group of people, and mostly the small business owner. And that, I think, may drive people away from carrying health insurance for their employees.
Mr. Chairman?
Right. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that medical assistance does cover this therapy and that MCHA does. I don't know, and I think that's what families have to do now. I think that's where they go for the coverage.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Pete. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We do cover some of the services that are named. It is not entirely clear, and we're working with the author in the House, and we would be happy to work with Senator Scheid as well to clarify what is the difference between the services that are covered by Minnesota medical assistance and other health care programs and those that are specified here. We do pay for a certain number of services to children with autism that are the same as or similar to these services. They mostly come under children's therapeutic services and supports in the community and mostly are billed as skills training kinds of services, and then I think there is also some incidental coverage of the OTPT speech, as Mr. Bartsch mentioned. But we believe that there is a difference, perhaps a gulf, you know, maybe it's wide, between what's contemplated in this bill and what we cover at this point. And if we determine that the difference is big, there would be a fiscal note from the department.
Thank you, Ms. Pete. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I would think if there was a fiscal note, it would be a fiscal savings, because these are costs that tend to be shifted either to MSHA, which is something that the state will occasionally contribute to, or to the Department of Human Services to provide coverage where it because it isn't provided in under the policy.
Senator Scheid.
We haven't gotten any money lately for MSHA. Somebody's pointing out we get no state money for it. But we are paying. I mean, all of us are paying. Well, actually, we're not, because I guess the state doesn't. But the fact is that's a cost to society. And I think the trouble is that you don't get the you get the savings probably in the K-12 system. In other areas, if you're talking about the overall savings, I mean, this will be a savings to us as a society. But, and as I said, I mean, what I keep going back to is that this is being covered by some plans. And if they're having the kind of success rate of 50%, I think that's, you know, that they can show that's evidence based, that's pretty strong. And I don't think there's anything in here that says a plan. Maybe I'm wrong. Mr. Bartz, does this say that if somebody signs up with a provider of one of these services, that they you just come in and say, you have to cover that? I mean, don't you have to approve providers and have contracts with them about, you know, what your rate, you know, your reimbursement rate is, et cetera? Don't you do those things?
Mr. Bartsch.
Plans?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do network, we do contract with providers to create our own network. We also have to credential providers. What I mentioned is a change in the federal mental health parity law, which will apply to the states, and it says that the benefits you have for medical coverage have to be the same for mental health coverage. All of our medical benefits have an out-of-network benefit, so you can seek services from a provider who is out of our contracted network, and we will reimburse a percentage of those expenses. That same situation would apply to mental health providers, including providers of IEIBT and other autism services.
Thank you. Let's try to – Ms. Smith, let's
Mr.
try
Chairman,
to get
yeah,
to
I'd like
testifiers,
to
and then we can have some more committee discussion. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Stacia Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is the largest business advocacy organization in the state. We represent over 2,700 members. 80% of those are considered small employers, meaning they have 100 employees or fewer. And I am no expert on autism, and I won't pretend to be. We oppose this bill simply because we see it as another mandate on the fully insured market. As already discussed, the fully insured market is only 27% of those covered, and it falls disproportionately on small to medium-sized businesses and individuals. For our membership, increases in health care costs are one of the top concerns, and mandates such as these, we believe, will lead to contribute to rising costs for premiums. Currently, Minnesota has 64 mandates. This is the most in the country, and it's hard to tell which one will be the tipping point for employers to just stop offering health care altogether. I'll keep my testimony brief. I just want to say that we want to go on record as opposing this bill because it is another mandate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, for a number of years, I've been trying to get the mandates quantified in terms of what does a mandate or a group, a set of mandates, cost, and we have not ever seen that provided to us about if you add this, cost will go up this much, or if you add this group of benefits, it'll go up, or if you take them away, it'll go down. So I kind of gave up on that. On that concern, because I don't know that you can that it can be quantified. We're paying now.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid. We did have some testimony from the Department of Commerce and our healthcare with the Healthcare Access Commission's working groups. And the testimony that we received is that all the focus on mandates, according to this, the Commerce Department, was really misplaced. The mandate that really has an impact is the one that requires maternity coverage to be included. And if we didn't do that, then we could easily see that women would have a harder time getting jobs because it would be cheaper to hire a man where you're not having to pay for that type of coverage. So
there are those kinds of societal considerations as well. But that was their testimony anyway.
Mr. Hickey.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Briefly, please.
I will. I understand the gravity. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities with about 13,000 members. Members, we're clearly the most affected constituency of these mandates, and I've talked a few times already this year, so I want to make a few brief comments. This is a compelling problem and a serious problem, but as was mentioned before, this is a broken model, continuing to put new burdens and new mandates on 27% of the insured population. I got a question. What percent of the advocates will benefit from this? Do they know if they're with a fully insured plan or are they with an ERISA plan? You'd probably have to go talk to your boss or maybe somebody in your human resources department to find out if you're even going to benefit from what you're supporting today. And if you look at the numbers, very few will, 27% based on the best analysis we got. But I realize it's a very moving and difficult problem, but if this turns out to be as expensive as some of the insurers fear, there's going to be fallout from this. Our employer is going to drop family coverage. Our employer is going to drop coverage altogether. How much of a hit would an employer tolerate for one mandate? We've had about 8 of these proposed this year, but this one potentially expensive. And so just a lot of concerns. It's why you've heard them before, but this is a broken model. This is a system that doesn't work anymore, continuing to try to mandate on this shrinking group of people, ironically, those who can afford it the least, and not covering the largest, richest companies in this state. And so I just urge you to not support this. This bill really needs further analysis. It'd be great if it could be put through the mandate review process. And finally, I just want to urge you to support an amendment, if it does come up, to fully extend this to the full public program. I know there is about $11 million of coverage right now per year, but that's where a lot of the potential people who need this benefit may be, and I really urge you to fully extend this to the public program if you're going to put this kind of potentially expensive mandate on small employers and individuals. And thanks for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey.
Members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid, that's the end of the testimony that
Mr.
I have on
Chairman,
our
list. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill as amended. It needs to go to health. They've requested this, so.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scheid, if I could, a couple of questions for you, and then I would like to offer an amendment. The first one is about the impact of mandates. Senator Scheid, I've always believed that, you know, mandates, and we can feel that, you know, many of them may be justified, but we've always kind of thought that we always acknowledge that there's a cost to them, although we couldn't quantify it. And I know you just stated that because you can't quantify it, then I guess I got the impression that it didn't matter. It's because you can't quantify it. We have 64 mandates currently. Why not 128? Why not 264? Why is there any limit then if we can't quantify it? I think we know that there's a cost to it, but just because we can't quantify it, we know there's pressure. Isn't that correct, Senator Scheid?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, I hope, I'm sorry if I implied that it didn't matter, but I'm saying I just, it's hard for me to have the concern that this is the straw that will break the camel's back. This is the one. And I've been here probably too many years, and I've heard it many, many times. This seems to me to be really smart money, even if it does cost more in the beginning, because it will cost less later.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, I'd like to maybe to clarify a little more about who this is really, who's going to be paying for this. We heard some testimony about this falling on 27% of the market. Is that
Mr.
Is that
Chairman and rising?
Is that correct?
Senator Chairman, Scheid. I guess that's right, but it is rising. That number is going up.
Okay.
Senator Gerlach.
Well, that's how many are in the fully insured market. I thought that was going down. What am I missing something on the trend on that? I thought the fully insured market was going down.
Actually, Mr. Senator Chairman, Scheid. I think it's going up.
It's going down.
Is it? Oh, there's...
It's going up.
Oh, I think there's some disagreement on that.
Senator Gerlach.
Medical field expert.
Well, Senator Scheid, I think that's... I think it's
Chairman, why doesn't Senator Gerlach just offer his amendment?
My point is, I believe that the fully insured market is a dwindling supply of, you know, folks, and primarily those are, you know, the large companies, as was said, they're essentially opting out of these mandates because they're becoming self-insured, and we're left with small businesses. And my concern is really that we're putting larger and larger burdens on small business. And if we were doing this in a vacuum where the outside economy didn't matter, then we could really let's talk about what we can do to help people that need the help and everything we can. But it's the small business that's going to generate the economy, that's going to get us out of the depression we're in. I'm using the word depression because that's really where, you know, and we're putting a heavier burden on small business, a small market. So anyway, I have some trouble with that.
Mr. Chairman.
You go ahead and respond, then we'll do the amendment.
Senator Shy.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dawson would like to just respond.
Ms. Dawson.
Mr. Chairman, a couple weeks ago, I met with some clients, a family whose 17-year-old, almost 18-year-old, has autism. And the father was just fired by his small to medium-sized employer because his kid incurred over $100,000 in bills. You know why? Because he's 17 and he didn't have effective or early intensive behavior intervention. He didn't have the opportunity for effective therapy, so he needed an inpatient residential treatment facility for just a couple of months. And he's probably going to need that again in the future.
Senator Gerlach. Well,
Mr. Chairman, another comment that was made was about extending this to public programs through medical assistance. And I guess let me just, for the point of discussion, because I think it's important to understand where the burdens of these are falling on, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. If I could at this time, okay. I think it's...
we've
got it already. Oh, sorry, Mr.
That's all right.
Mr.
Okay.
Chairman, I don't have it, however.
Senator Shide, I sent you a copy.
I have a copy here.
Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Shide, I sent you a copy of this earlier. This amendment makes this bill apply to the public programs. And it was said earlier, actually the number was said was about $11 million. I show it's closer to $12 million on some documentation I have on that. But if we can, I'm not an expert in this area, but I just feel that there is a fairness issue. I'm concerned about the state of small business in the state, and I feel like we're doing kind of a pile on, and I understand the needs, but if we're going to get our economy on track, we can't keep throwing this on just such a small sliver of the marketplace in small businesses.
We really don't need to do this, and I believe that it's already being covered. We have lots of testimony we could now provide that it is being covered that way. I don't think you need to do this. It just does damage to the bill.
Senator Olson?
And
to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shide, just from sitting on the Health and Human Services Committee, I just foresee what would happen with this amendment is that we wouldn't get any credit in a fiscal note for the fact that we're going to have tax-paying citizens adding to our future revenues. We wouldn't get any credit for the reduction in PCA services that are needed for children who have access to this or assisted living costs. I mean, if we were to be able to take every adult now who has autism that we're paying for through the department costs and reduce that by 50 cents and they would credit that in the fiscal note, then you could really help out our budget. But I just know that wouldn't work that way. So I'm concerned about this amendment because I'm afraid it would be an artificial block to doing the right thing.
Senator Metzen.
Not on the amendment.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
I would move my amendment.
Senator Gerlach renews his motion on the A2 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dawson, did you say, or somebody said that 38% of the health insurance is written in Minnesota by Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they cover this stuff.
And I'm just wondering if their rates are today comparable with, like, the other companies, or are they off the wall because they do cover this? Do you have an answer to that? Or?
Mr. Chairman?
That's the argument we're hearing, of course, all day. And but the one company with 38, 40% of the coverage covers this. So are their rates like...
Well.
Is that a fair question? You understand that? Yeah.
Yeah, I do. Mr. Chairman, to be clear, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota has 36% of the state-regulated market.
And okay, actually, not 38%, 36, okay. Yeah. That was pretty close.
Yeah, pretty good. And just of the state-regulated market. And my law firm actually just reconsidered, you know, we got together and we said, as every small business does, health insurance premiums are rising. What are we going to do about it? And we had a broker help us compare different policies and the premiums, and we decided to stick with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, not because I'm on it. We're not actually on it. My son has private insurance coverage for this through my husband's employer. But we actually did a market analysis just a couple of months ago, and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota had the most competitive product and the best coverage. I feel like a commercial for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota up here. But to tell you the truth, I've had a really good experience with them all my life. Well, all my son's life.
Well, that helps. Thank you. That kind of helps make the argument why we should probably do this, I guess.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scheid, I'm looking at a handout for your bill that's called Cost Comparison of Early Intensive Behavioral Intervention. The second to the last page, the second to last paragraph, says that we simply are offering a potential plan for saving money and maximizing recovery. Then it goes on to say, finally, our investigation acknowledges that children with autism will receive early intensive behavioral intervention, often do not fully recover, and that the residual symptoms of autism through the lifespan
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, can Senator Johnson tell me what page he's on? I don't have that.
410.
Ms. Dawson has it here.
Page 411 of the cost comparison study.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, my point is I just don't feel we should be mandating this. I think the intervention is out there, and we need to keep seeking for it. But it isn't something that we should necessarily mandate because there isn't any proof that it's totally effective.
I'm not sure that that's what if you're looking at that last paragraph, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. If you're looking where it says our analysis has its limitations, et cetera, is that the paragraph you're looking at?
The one above it. Starting with our investigation acknowledges.
Here.
Well.
Often do not fully recover.
Correct.
But I think that 48%. You know, what we say, like 48% do, and when I compared that to my own treatment, I thought those were pretty good. That was a pretty good percentage.
Senator Scheid,
Johnson.
That percentage isn't shown in this literature.
Ms. Dawson?
I could get you probably several dozen studies and reports that do reflect that.
Senator Olson.
And Mr. Chair, I would just direct Senator Johnson to the statement right above the one that she quoted, which says we are simply offering a potential plan for saving money by utilizing one of the most empirically supported treatments for autism to date. So, in other words, it's what they're saying here is that while everyone may not recover, this is the most supported treatment, according to this literature.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dawson.
I think it's actually trying to explain that they're doing a fairly responsible analysis. They're not assuming that every kid fully recovers. They're assuming that many kids don't, but that many of those kids do make some progress. And so, as I mentioned before, the average savings is $1 million, even though some kids won't even respond very well at all, and they won't make clinical progress, and they'll be discharged from treatment. Those kids, you're talking about a very, very short period of time that they get the therapy. the average savings is $1 million, and the maximum is probably in excess of $3 million. The reason it keeps getting higher is because some of these kids will earn money. Taxpayers.
Thank you. Senator Scheid renews her motion that Senate File 312 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Health, Housing, and Family Services Committee. Further discussion on the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Scheid.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to these. Mr. Chairman, I do want to thank the families and the children, especially for being such good citizens and being a good audience, and I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid, would you like to take Senate File 1743 or 1905 next?
Mr. Chairman, do I?
Will I get mine out?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. And also, you know, Mr. Chairman, I could do 1905, like, really quickly.
Okay, let's take Senate File 1905.
If you would.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
I would like to offer an author's amendment to delete Section 1. It definitely needs further discussion, and so I just want to take it out of the bill at this time, Section 1. I'd offer that.
Senator Scheid has moved the author's amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
No. The amendment is adopted. Senator
Chairman,
Scheid.
Thank you. I forgot to vote. Section 2, then, is just on the back, and it's four lines long, and it just talks about the commissioner and consultation with the Commissioner of Health, obviously, employers and health plan companies developing a uniform health coverage application for applying for health care coverage. And I would like to move it. I think it does this also go to health?
I think so.
That's why I just. Do you have another amendment?
I'm sure I put together an author's amendment on that section of the bill as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, recommend to the, yes, thank
yes.
you. Thank you, it's the A1. So this would, after they develop that, they would recommend it to the legislature, and we are talking about coverage in the small employer market. So there just really needs to be conversation about what it means from going to 50 to 100. I'm not prepared to do that here. And or probably
we also have the A1 author's amendment, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I just described, yeah.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Scheid.
Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate File 1905 as amended be recommended to pass, and I believe that the Health Committee.
We referred to the Health Committee. That is correct.
Security has asked for that.
Any further discussion? On Senator Scheid's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
The bill is passed. And we refer to health.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to be hogging this table to back here. I just have bills that have to go to. And I then would bring up 1743. It also has to go to the Health Committee.
Okay.
And I think through with me.
Senate File 1743, Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Chairman. This bill is an amendment, an author's amendment, the A6. So don't even look at the original, please.
A4.
I'm sorry, it's the A4.
A4.
Forgive me.
Not the boss of you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this would put it in the
okay.
sense to discuss it.
A4 is coming around to members. Senator Scheid moves the A4 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, this will have to go to health as well. This This bill came to me through Representative Abler, and he had concerns about what are called TPAs, third-party administrators of the coverage of his reimbursement. In this case, he's a chiropractor. And it applies to third-party administrators. If you look on page 3, that's the new language, I think, under Section 1. And that's where it says they can't, the third-party administrator or the health plan not collect from a provider money that's owed by a patient as a copay or deductible. So that's essentially what that new language says in Section 1. And Section 2 has to do with clearinghouses. I thought there was an incorrect reference, but it was pointed out to me that actually we, in Section 1, create the new reference on line 4.12, 68.23, sub 8, paragraph, parent C, clause, parent C. I mean, paragraph, parent 6, clause, parent C. And it is a correct reference now because we've just established that in Section 1. So, and paragraph C has to do with saying that the third-party administrator or the health plan can be less than required less than 90 days for submitting a claim. Section 3 and the rest of the bill has to do with when the professional person who owns the business may die. And currently there's a 90-day requirement for the surviving spouse to sell that, to divest of that business. They are disqualified being able to own that business. Obviously, if they were also a licensed professional, they'd be fine. But this... all of this language says we're just changing that current 90-day requirement to 1 year to give them the opportunity,
we'll get them, Tiger,
particularly, I guess, in this market, to be able to sell that business. This also comes from Representative Abler and has, I suspect, well, it has to do with, he's a chiropractor, and I think he's seen this arise in that industry. I'm sure it happens in others as well. Chairman, then I have an amendment I'd like to offer, and that's the A6. And then I need Mr. Johnson. Oh, he's right there.
It's going to do it shorter than me.
Good.
No, that's good.
See you for a while. Mr. Chairman,
yeah, sorry,
if I might offer the A6, and Mr. Peter Thrain,
we have, just come around.
Is here
we're
at the table with
have.
Me.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, thank you. My name is Peter Thrain, and I represent State Farm Mutual Insurance Company, Minnesota's largest writer of auto insurance. We write approximately 1 million cars in the state of Minnesota, which is almost 20% of the Minnesota market. The amendment before you today addresses legislation that was enacted in 2007 mandating that medical claims to insurers be sent and remitted electronically. Regardless of whether the payer is a health plan, a private passenger auto insurer, or a workers' compensation insurer, Minnesota is the first state in the nation to mandate electronic bill payment by private passenger auto insurers. We support this provision. State Farm believes this is progress, and if it can get done and get done right, this will be significant progress, and it will be beneficial to our policyholders. The administrative rules promulgated by the Department of Health to implement this mandate are very detailed and very technical, and they're based on the federal HIPAA legislation. The federal HIPAA legislation, however, applies to health plans and doesn't apply to private passenger auto insurers or property casualty insurers. As a consequence, there's elements of the rules today that don't contemplate the unique requirements that are impacted upon private passenger auto insurers. We're subject to a number of laws dictating the timing and terms for paying bills from healthcare providers delivering medical care, provisions in the work comp laws, and also provisions in the no-fault auto laws. For example, Minnesota's no-fault law says that insurer must pay the provider within 30 days of when a claim is received. But the new mandate says that we can't pay a bill if it's not submitted pursuant to their rules. Effectively, auto insurers are going to be put in the position of trying to decide which set of rules they're going to operate under. The 62J mandates that all group purchasers, which in this case includes private passenger auto insurers and healthcare providers, must exchange claims data electronically. This language essentially no longer allows for paper billings. Moreover, the Commissioner of Health is required to mandate rules pursuant to which group purchasers are required to follow. On the other hand, the no-fault law in the state of Minnesota mandates that PIP benefits are payable as losses incurred. Benefits are overdue if not paid within 30 days after the auto insurer receives reasonable proof of the fact and the amount of the loss realized, regardless of whether the bill is in electronic or a paper form. State Farm has worked closely and attempted to work closely with the regulators as the administrative rules have been promulgated. As I say, this is a first in the nation. This is a complicated system. It's built on a health insurance platform, which does not readily lend itself to property casualty insurers. We've asked for specific guidance. We've had letters going to the department. We've initiated meetings. We provided them with scenarios. And we're not quite getting the results and the help that we need to make this work in the state of Minnesota. Again, we support electronic data exchange for medical bills. We just need this to work for private passenger auto insurers who operate under an entirely different set of rules. The amendment simply states two requirements. One, that the rules must address the property casualty requirements, the no-fault requirements, in order to be enforced. And two, the Commissioner of Health can't penalize a property casualty insurer for using reasonable efforts to comply with the property casualty laws. We hope this provides an opportunity to get the administrative rules and get the law to put us in a position so that private passenger auto insurers can be fully understand and fully participate and plug ourselves into these requirements. We would very much appreciate your support of this requirement. We are just hoping not to put ourselves in a position of choosing which set of laws we're going to violate, and we hope this provides an opportunity to harmonize these laws. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thrain. Senator Prettner, I don't know who was first, Prettner Solon. Prettner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I missed your name.
Thrain.
Peter Thrain, yes.
Thrain. Mr. Thrain, maybe I'm dense, but I still don't, I'm not clear why you think that you can't comply with this. And it makes me very, very anxious because I have these small providers in my community who are having a very hard time complying with the electronic billing that we're doing right now that is mandated to take place pretty soon. You know, small psychology offices of 1 to 3 people, they're going to have a hard time. And it's going to be very hard to explain to them why they have to comply if you don't have to comply. So you have to help me understand. I didn't understand that distinction, why you shouldn't comply.
Mr. Chairman, if I might say something,
Senator,
this isn't about them not doing it, Senator Prettner-Solon. This is about resolving that conflict of the two sections of law, 62J and 65B.
Well, I don't see.
Senator Prettner-Solon, you're okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Senator Scheid, I still don't understand what the conflict is.
Mr. Thrain.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Solon, 65B.54, which is the no-fault law, says that we are obligated to pay a claim within 30 days of having reasonable proof of the loss. And that's the circumstance under which we operate under the no-fault law. The electronic bill paying mandate, though, says that we are obligated, though, to operate in an electronic environment. So if we don't receive reasonable proof of the loss, we have a conflict. We have an electronic pipeline that will not provide us with the information to address these things. And so we're going to be put in the position of saying, should we comply with the 30-day mandate on one hand, or should we comply with the electronic mandate on the other hand?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Maybe, I think somebody might be here from MDH, but with the 30 days, I'm not sure what would start the clock on the 30 days.
Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. I'm David Haugen with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm serving as a project manager for the rulemaking for the standard electronic exchange of healthcare administrative transactions. These are the rules that Mr. Thrain has mentioned recently. And if I could, I would just like to respond to some of the discussion so far. The department is really seeing this amendment, I think, for the first time, and certainly would like some more time to review it, but would have some concerns. I think the practical implication of the amendment is that conceivably it would effectively exempt this group of insurers from the requirements for electronic standard transactions, which has been pointed out do apply to all payers and all healthcare providers, even smaller healthcare providers. Just to clarify a little bit more about these rules, it has been mentioned that as a result of statute, starting on July 15th of this year, there will be requirements in effect that claims or billings between providers and payers will be exchanged electronically using a standard data content and format. That means that now there are many transactions that are occurring electronically, but some on paper. And even under the current environment, without these rules taking effect, there are certainly situations where those paper claims might be filled out the way they're supposed to be and then sent in, but there might be some kind of delay or problem. For example, the payer may require additional information, known as attachments, that may slow things up. There are currently these kind of situations occurring all the time. They are not being caused by the switchover to electronic transactions. These situations currently exist. The Department of Commerce, as I understand it, currently addresses these. There are mechanisms in place to address these. So this is not, again, an outcome of the change to electronic standard transactions. In addition, it's quite likely that with transactions going electronically rather than by paper, that if there are some problems, they'll come to the attention of providers and payers more quickly to be more quickly resolved. So again, we would have concerns about this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Haugen. Senator Shide.
Mr. Chairman, so I'm assuming that the electronic billing requirement also requires the 30-day payment? I mean, I don't think it does. And I think that's the problem. We've got companies that are required to make that payment by Chapter 65B, which I don't think this law change contemplated, nor do I think that the rules address it yet. So that's we're correct. Just saying there is a conflict. Please resolve it for the companies that have to abide by 62J and 65B, which is the no fault.
Mr. Haugen, would you like to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, members, the rules that I'm referencing are required of the Department of Health under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 62J.536. That statutory requirement for rulemaking makes no reference to the 30-day prompt payment requirement. It's just simply not addressed in the statute. The statute essentially provides authority to the Department of Health to create rules to translate paper forms that are now being used into an electronic version. It really doesn't change anything else. Those laws that existed previously about prompt payment are still there and still apply. Our rules simply don't relate to those. These are really unrelated issues in that way.
Senator Prentner-Soul and then Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Haugen, if we were to pass this legislation, how would it affect that language that or that that legislation that will be coming into effect on July 15th?
Mr. Haugen?
Mr. Chair, members, our concern would be that it would seem to me that until the additional steps and rules that are required as a result of this amendment are taken, that carriers could say that because of this perceived conflict, they don't feel that they can move ahead in implementing and becoming ready to comply with the rules, that effectively they would be exempted, and that while many other payers and providers would have to comply, I think they could make the argument that they don't have to.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Mr. Thrain to speak to that question of Senator Pretnisol.
Senator Thrain, or Mr. Thrain.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, the issue we have is we would very much like this to work for private passenger auto insurers. The private passenger auto world is very different than the health insurance world. We have a different set of claims. We have different kinds of claim sets. We have different data needs. And so when the data that comes through the electronic pipeline doesn't come through entirely or we receive a paper claim, we're put in a position of not knowing whether we should comply with the no-fault requirement or whether we should comply with the electronic requirement. And our intention with the amendment is simply to harmonize these requirements. We would very much like these rules to address these issues. We have asked the Department of Health, and we have posed these issues to them. We proposed issues in October. We proposed a set of scenarios in February. We want this to work. We just need to make certain that it plugs in the necessary elements for private passenger auto insurers. And we have some letters we can show that go into some of the detail. This is very technical areas. Today, though, the data elements necessary to push the billing through the pipeline doesn't address the things necessary for an auto insurer to comply with the no-fault law.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, I'm really concerned with what I perceive to be an out for insurance companies not to have to pay these claims within 30 days, because what tends to happen is when the claims are not paid within 30 days, then the consumer ends up with an unpaid bill and collection action starts. So that's my concern. That's how I'm perceiving this as the possibility that that could happen.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's my concern, because they have to comply with the 30-day, but it may not work. And you're putting them in the 62J, 65B. And I mean, I know you know 65B really well, and you know the requirements, and that 30-day requirement is really important. And it's just a matter of trying to make the transition. They're not trying to avoid paying within 30 days. That is not. They're trying to be able to be sure they can comply with it appropriately. So, I mean, that's.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, that's the point. We would very much like to comply with the no-fault law. That's our desire. But if we get a paper bill, can we pay it? The electronic data requirement would seem to indicate that we can't. We would like to pay that bill. We don't want to have to choose to comply with the no-fault law versus choosing to comply with the electronic data law. We operate very well in the no-fault world. We want to make certain, though, that that's mapped into and is incorporated into the rules promulgated by the Department of Health for the electronic world.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's 62Q.75 subdivision 3? Because this is on line 4.12, because it says the clearinghouse must not enforce a deadline shorter than the period provided in 62Q.75.
Now Mr. Johnson can respond to that. You know,
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Senator Johnson. Olson, the 62Q.75 provision you referenced is the clean bill statute for major medical claims, so it defines what a clean bill is. And that subdivision 3 includes in it a statute of limitations or 180 day time frame within which claims must be filed by providers. And that subdivision also includes no-fault auto, the PIP medical, and workers' compensation medical. So they are treated in that one subdivision of the clean claim laws as subject to that 180 time for day period within which bills have to be filed.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, this looks like, and maybe I'm missing something here, but it concerns me then that what we're saying is that the bills wouldn't have to be, you can't enforce a deadline less than 180 days. That's way too long for a bill to be paid. And so,
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the problem. We have conflicting statutes.
Mr. Haugen?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd just like to clarify something, if I might, and take issue with a statement that Mr. Thrain made when he said that the electronic health care claims that we've developed simply don't work for auto carriers. We have worked very hard with the industry and with a very large voluntary stakeholder group, the Administrative Uniformity Committee, in developing the rules Our work has included numerous meetings, including on several occasions, very large meetings that were publicized nationally. We had representatives from State Farm who actually came from Illinois and attended those meetings in person. And as a result of very, very detailed examination of the claims forms and the electronic requirements, the agreement was that, in fact, these claim forms do work for property casualty, auto, workers' compensation, and other insurance carriers who previously had not been covered by these kinds of transactions. So on that basis, we have been proceeding. We have certainly had a great deal of involvement by State Farm and work with them throughout this whole process.
Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Mr. Chair, I've been working on uniform forms and the electronic transmission and everything, too. And Ms. Commit has been assisting with some of this. And she has testified on a uniform form that they're bringing forward. I'm wondering if we could hear from her briefly about this, because she's trying to address this very issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shea.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if they're talking about the HIPAA, you know, those entities that are covered by HIPAA. I mean, I think that's their familiarity level. This isn't covered by HIPAA as far as I know. And so there's a real fundamental problem. And, well, I just don't think that they're misleading us, and the committee can do what they will, but there's a problem. And you're going to put some insurance companies in conflict with two statutes. And I don't know. I'd like to see what, and maybe Mr. Thrain can get the comments or the, you know, recommendations of the people who participated in that group.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just a comment that hasn't been made yet, and just an example. There's one other state in this country that's gone to an EDI system in the property casualty area. Texas has gone EDI in the workers' compensation arena, but here's an illustration. Texas, in their adoption of the rules that Mr. Haugen referenced, incorporated referencing their state work comp law in the way that we're asking today in this amendment. We're not against, in fact, we're in support of the property casualty, and the provisions cited here strictly go to the period of time within which we have to pay claims. So, Senator Olson, the 65B54 is the 30-day period. The reference to the 176-194, the workers' compensation law, there is a similar statute to that no-fault law that requires us to pay within 45 days. So the point is that we have existing laws that were all drafted in a paper environment. We support those laws, but we now are, you know, by law are going to be required to have all of our medical bills conform to the electronic 62J system. And we just simply, we're asking that they be integrated. I don't know that it's that significant a request to have the rules recognize these property casualty standards, because we want to comply with them. I think as it sits today, as Mr. Haugen said, the companion guides don't have any time frames in them. So, all right, so now our medical bills are going to go in the electronic box, and without time frames, these property casualty existing statutes are going to be, we're going to hit those time frames, and if we haven't paid, we've broken the law. We've broken the law, the 65B, and we're saying help us. We want to, well, let's get in the electronic box, but help us so in that electronic box, which doesn't have time frames, help us not violate the law at the 30 and the 45-day time period. We're on board and saying help us get integrated into the 62J536 electronic EDI box, which covers all medical bills, but the rules as they sit today do not do that.
Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Mr. Chair, could we hear from Ms. Commit? Because I think that's what she's trying to do, is to help you to comply.
Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Commit. I'm from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And I wasn't planning on testifying on this bill today, but because of this issue that I just realized there was going to be this amendment, and I thought it would be helpful for the committee to hear something that the Minnesota Council of Health Plans is doing in a positive manner. This law, 62J.536, required these standardized forms of communicating between providers and payers, which included all of the insurance companies. And in addition, it all had to be done electronically. The health plans anticipated that there would be a number of small providers out there who would not be able to comply with this law or who would not know that it had passed and would have trouble. We also recognized that there were other payers out there, automobile insurance companies, workers' comp, property and casualty insurers who occasionally, like property and casualty, who occasionally have a medical claim. And so we got together, we developed an RFP, we went out into the marketplace and tried to identify a number of vendors who might have a solution for this process, and we have identified a vendor. The individual health plans are in the final stages of negotiating with this vendor to create a process so that a provider or, like the kind of provider that Senator Prettner-Solon was describing, a one- or two-person shop, or a large insurance company that does business in all 50 states but doesn't want to have to change all their systems in Minnesota because they're going to because it's so expensive and they have 49 other states that they're doing business in. But the system will allow somebody to be able to send a transaction over the internet through a secured website, both from the payer to the provider as well as from the provider to the payer. So it's just an option that's available out there. Nobody's required to use it, but when we developed this option and we made sure that it would be it would work for dental claims, workers' comp, P&C, and auto. So I just want to share that with the committee. And that should be up and running for 7/15/09.
Thank you for your testimony.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly respect Ms. Kmit and the plans. I understand what they're saying. It doesn't take away the conflict of the two requirements. And so if we can't address it, and it appears that the department can't, I'd like to see something from the department, if I might ask Mr. Haugen, to show me how it will work and that we can guarantee that people with no-fault claims will be paid within the 30 days and workers' comp claims within the 45. I just would like to see how we can guarantee that these companies will be in compliance with 65B, which is, of course, not referenced in 62J. So,
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, my concern is that it seemed like what the Department of Health was saying is that this issue of a time limit isn't addressed at all in the electronic medical records statute. But we have other laws which we're both familiar with, that say these bills have to be paid within a certain period of time. And what I'm concerned is that this legislation is kind of allowing an out from those time requirements. And again, maybe I'm not reading it right, but it seems like I understand that they have to have the information that says more than just a normal bill, because they have to know if it was the result of a car accident or something like that to know if they should be paying it. But why is that a conflict? I mean, why is there a conflict if one doesn't have a rule and the other one? Maybe I'm still not understanding this right.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding. I mean, I'm grasping this is that they may not be able to pay some claims within 30 days that they're required to. I mean, is that's a real possibility that 65B requires, not 62J. Is that?
Mr.
And that's
Haugen.
A concern when you're not in compliance because the Department of Health isn't monitoring 65B.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid.
Mr. Thrain.
That is the concern. If we receive reasonable proof, however it's received under Chapter 65B, we're required to pay it in 30 days. 62J, though, says that we can only transmit medical bills electronically. What are we to do? Are we to not ignore 62J and comply with 65B, the timing requirements, or are we to ignore the timing requirements in 65B.43 and comply with the electronic data statements. We'd like to comply with both, but we certainly don't want to be put in the position of having to choose. And if the rules could sort of accommodate all of the things that we need to process claims on a property casualty basis, we will be in compliance with both. Today, though, there's some technical issues that need to be worked out. We've asked for that to be worked out, but still need to be worked out. And I say this is the first in the country to do this, so difficulty here wouldn't be uncommon, but thank you.
63B. Mr. Chairman, I think we've made the point, and if the committee doesn't care if they follow, I think you do care. I know you care. But if we put them between a rock and a hard place, we have to choose a statute. I don't think that's right, but I don't know. I don't mean to put Mr. Haugen on the spot, but I would like to see some clarification how we can be absolutely certain that companies will not be in the position of violating 65B. There's nothing in 62J requirement, the electronic billing, that could cause them to be in violation of 65B, and I'd just like to see that.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, I would like to hear from Mr. Haugen, because what I was heard was that the conflict existed before, it doesn't resolve the conflict, and it, this has to do with the electronic transmission. And could Mr. Haugen respond to that?
Mr. Haugen.
Mr. Chair, members, again, there were requirements already in law for 30-day prompt payment of claims that existed before we started our rulemaking. If we stopped our rulemaking or didn't complete our rulemaking or if there was no requirement for the rules, those statutes would still exist. Our rules simply don't relate to those other statutes. There are statutes that require claims be paid within certain time intervals. We're not changing those statutes. We're not influencing them. We don't really have anything to do with our rules and those statutes. If anything, our hope is that by transacting these exchanges electronically, it actually helps speed up the whole process and foster the intent of that prompt payment activity.
Senator.
So, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Prettner-Solon.
So you're saying that these don't relate to the problem that we have, that if we pass this, all this will do is say that they don't have to transmit electronically.
Mr. Haugen.
Mr. Chair, members, that would be our concern, is that this amendment would effectively, could be effectively pointed to by carriers to say that they don't feel they have to comply.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Only if the department doesn't deal with it in the rule. I think the companies are more than willing to comply. They just would like these concerns addressed in the rule. That apparently isn't going to happen.
Senator Olson.
Well, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, but it just, again, it seems like we're having some confusion in some different issues. One is this going to be an out for not complying with submitting the electronic records? The other concern I have is that it says they can't enforce a shorter deadline for submissions of claims than what's provided in 62Q, and I thought I was hearing that there are no deadlines right now in 62Q.
That's a problem.
Which means that
that's a problem, Mr. Chairman.
But then to me that means that we wouldn't be able to enforce the 30 or 45-day mandate because they are shorter deadlines and we'd basically be letting the insurance companies off the hook. They wouldn't have to meet those deadlines.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, so that you say they should choose 65B.
Senator Olson.
I mean, no. That's kind of what you are requiring a choice. Yeah, potentially.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, that's not how I'm looking at it. How I'm looking at it is the fact that they have to use electronic means of submitting claims back and forth is really a separate issue, as the Department of Health said, from the requirement that claims be paid in a particular amount of time. This should make it easier for them to do that, not harder. And should not be a reason to exempt them from those payment timelines.
Yes. Mr. Thrain, please.
Mr. Thrain.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, thank you. If we receive data outside of the electronic pipeline, we arguably are in violation of 62J. If we received information outside of the electronic pipeline, though, we have reasonable proof of a claim. That's how it works today. In a paper environment, Once we get reasonable proof of a claim, we pay it. That is the deadline. We're sort of focused in 65B. If it doesn't come through the electronic pipeline correctly, completely, timely, but we receive information of the claim, we then are put in the position of trying to being asked to ignore the electronic payment requirement or 65B.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Thrain, is it?
Yes.
Mr. Thrain, then I would feel a lot more comfortable with something that says that there must be the rulemaking must make sure that you have the information you need within the electronic process, which I'm hearing is already something that they're planning to do or in the process of doing, as opposed to just giving you an out from the 30 and 45 day payment requirements.
Mr. Chairman, they're not looking for an out for the 30 and 45 days. They're saying they may not be able to comply with those if the electronic billing isn't.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we're actually asking for an out of the electronic requirement if the rules don't get us the information we need electronically. But your provision, your suggestion about requiring the rules to address these things, we're all in favor of that, yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Scheid.
I'd like to keep working on this. I'm certainly willing to talk to Senator Olson about that language because we're not trying to see to do any end around or trying to avoid. We would like to comply with both statutes. They're required to. But it looks like it may be a technical impossibility in some circumstances. So, well, why would we do that? Why would we do that to consumers? So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd move the amendment. Decide what it wants to do with it.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator Scheid moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, then I'm going to move Senate File 1743 as amended, recommended to pass, and re-referred to Senator Marty's committee. He needed another bill.
Job security.
Actually.
On the Scheid motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Scheid. Thanks for
Chairman,
your patience,
Chairman, I think
committee.
Senator Dahl has one motion.
One motion. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I know we've been waiting patiently. And this should be very quick, and I beg the indulgence of the committee on this. I'm going to move to revisit Senate File 806, and let me give you my rationale, and then it's also going to be my testimony, basically. Senate File 806 is payday lending, and there have been people working on this for months and months since the last session, and now we have agreement with the stakeholders. We have agreement with payday lender, and we have pretty much no controversy left. The bill has basically been gutted. I will tell you that I'm going to introduce a delete all amendment if you allow me to revisit this bill, which very simply removes any requirements or references to an installment repayment agreement, no limits on the number of loans, no limits on fees or interest rates. Basically, it applies debt collection protections to the collection of payday loans, requires written contracts, makes unequivocal that Minnesota has jurisdiction over internet payday lenders, and adds a few more reporting requirements. Again, there's no longer any opposition, and I commend the stakeholders that got together on this. So with that, I would move that you revisit 806.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
Aye.
Thank you. With that, I have the A5 amendment. And again, I really appreciate the committee in taking this up again. There's been so much work, and the fact, again, I appreciate the fact that the people involved in Payday America and others did come together with legal aid and worked out some agreement, a first step in addressing the kind of discussion that we had on the payday lending industry in Minnesota, and the fact that they were willing to, they could have walked away and said, you know, we're not interested in working with you, and the fact that they were able to do that, I appreciate that greatly. So the A5 amendment, again, if you have any questions about it, take my word for it. It basically.
Lay it on the table.
Not this building.
I, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dow.
I do want to also say some one little technical issue that came up. This does have to go to judiciary. It is a judicial matter. It was brought up by the CFSA, and they do have a resolution. They're committing to get that done before it goes to judiciary. And if CFSA is here, they would say that they, too, agreed that there's a minor technical glitch that they can agree upon before judiciary. So, again, I beg the indulgence of the committee to please support the work that's been done in this for quite a long time on the Senate File 806, now as amended.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Dow. Would anyone else like to be heard briefly on Senate File 806?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Well, maybe we'll hear the testimony, but just I congratulate Senator Dahl for bringing or helping to bring all parties together. And that's how the system should work around this building, where you can. I remember old Senator Sam Solon, when he chaired the committee, he'd say, hey, listen, go out in the hall, come back in about an hour tomorrow morning or the next day, figure it out. And that's what I think has happened here. I hope that's what's happened. And I hope people are in agreement, but I'm not so sure.
Mr. Lady.
He's smiling, so I don't know if it's okay. But that's good work, is what it
is. Mr. Layton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandeveer, did you have a comment?
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you for noting that.
It's been a long day.
I just wanted to ask if I could, Senator Dahl. Some of the bills change when they leave here and go to judiciary. This wouldn't do that, would it?
Senator Dahl?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vandeveer, no, this is, again, a very minor technical change, I've been assured, and Ron Elwood is shaking his head. But, again, I would not do that. That's not the way I operate. And believe me, this is about as pure a bill as you're going to see it going forward.
Senator Vandeveer. Mr. Layton.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'll be very brief. Senator Metzen said a lot of discussions have been taking place in the hallway. That's continued. A new issue just arose a couple of minutes ago. My name is Rob Layton. I'm with Nolan McGregor Thompson Layton Law Firm, and I'm here on behalf of Unloan Corporation, which is a Minnesota-based company that provides payday loans. A new issue that arose that we will be able to work out. So we support this bill coming out of committee today. Simply relates to the language in Section 3, Subdivision 3, that relates to debt collection. We have a concern. Just wanted to note that that language could possibly interfere with the current practice of suing unpaid loans or debts through conciliation court, which is a low-cost method of resolving these types of actions without the need for attorney's fees. That's not the intent of the bill. I've spoken to Mr. Elwood about it. It's an issue that just came up as a concern, and he's told me that we will talk about this. If this needs to be addressed and fixed, we'll do that in the next committee. But it's an issue of importance to my client, and Mr. Elwood's aware of that. We'll try to get that fixed, and we support it moving out of this committee.
Thank you. Then Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 806 is amended. Do you recommend it to pass?
We need to adopt the amendment.
Oh, we need to adopt the amendment. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A5 amendment first.
On Senator Dahl's motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Senate File 806 as amended.
Be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Aye. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dahl. And, yeah, thank you, members. We had a long meeting today, but we do have four additional bills we need to get through next Tuesday. So.
Senator Dahl, I was just going to say.
With that, meeting's adjourned.
Judiciary Committee sometimes.